Chapter 2. I don't have those numbers. January 20th, 2017. You can kind of see people way down there in the distance, but it's a bit lonely out here at the moment. I told Mika Brzezinski on Inauguration Day, smiling awkwardly while reporting live on Morning Joe. The Capitol building and the stage where Trump would soon walk out were just over a mile away, and in between us lay lots of white plastic floor mats with barely a soul on them. If you want proof Donald Trump didn't have the largest, biggest, best inauguration crowd ever, I'm your man. I got the plum assignment of covering the inauguration of President Donald J. Trump from the farthest possible position along the National Mall, the way, way back near where the press tent was built to accommodate a massive crowd. And there wasn't one. When President Obama was inaugurated, the crowd stretched all the way down to the Washington Monument. That was 1.8 million folks. We'll see how many people show up today. And with that, I threw to commercial break. A lonely correspondent in a sea of nobody at the inauguration of the 45th President of the United States of America. Where I was standing, company never came. After a few more live shots and a few more people showed up, that back area never was packed as the satellite imagery confirmed, I gave back my stick mic, pulled out my earpiece, and started walking back toward our hotel. As we left the mall, we walked with protesters, who for the most part were peaceful. More protesters were preparing to show up in the same place at the same time the following morning for the Women's March, an event organized to take place globally in resistance to the Trump presidency. One of them was a career employee at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, who would, weeks later, march again, this time against Trump's plans to ban Muslims from entering the United States and to build a border wall. That official was not the lone government employee marching discreetly in opposition to the new president. The State Department, too, was informally represented. The HHS official described knowing people who became, quote, physically sick when Trump was elected. I was absolutely terrified about what he would do. This type of opposition to President Trump's stated immigration policies wasn't surprising. To many career officials across the government, Trump's xenophobic campaign rhetoric was great cause for concern. Just short of the Trump administration's one-month anniversary, that rhetoric became reality amongst those caring for migrant children seeking refuge in the United States. February 14, 2017. A Valentine's Day meeting had been convened in the fourth-floor suite of acting U.S. Customs and Border Protection Commissioner Kevin McAleenan, and on the agenda was ending the practice known as catch-and-release. Only 25 days into the Trump administration, and they were hitting the ground running. But what would that mean? That question was front of mind as Commander Jonathan White walked into the Ronald Reagan Building and International Trade Center in Washington, D.C., the federal building that doubles as a wedding venue and event space, but also is the headquarters of U.S. Customs and Border Protection, where decisions affecting the fate of millions are made. White, a bick-bald career officer of the U.S. Public Health Service Commissioned Corps, the small army of thousands of federal government healthcare workers, was now serving his third presidential administration from inside the Department of Health and Human Services. A clinical social worker and emergency manager by education, he was now overseeing refugee programs for the United States federal government as the Deputy Director of the Office of Refugee Resettlement's Unaccompanied Alien Children Program within HHS's Administration for Children and Families. White's colleagues describe him as a man of unimpeachable integrity, with unparalleled devotion to the health and well-being of the children he served. Amongst the small, tight-knit group of career officials at ORR, that was the rule, not the exception. It was with that value set that Jim Dela Cruz, White's subordinate at ORR, had the previous year bemoaned the limited practice under the Obama administration of family separations to colleagues. White and others were about to find out if the Trump administration's Department of Homeland Security would be expanding the policy to match the president's tough talk on the campaign trail, and now that he was in the White House. They sat around the conference table, joined by McAleenan and representatives from other relevant government stakeholders, including the Department of Justice's Executive Office of Immigration Review, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and the Policy Shop at the Department of Homeland Security. It was so early in the administration that around the country, walls and offices just like this one were still missing photos of the newly inaugurated President Trump and Vice President Pence, as is customary at the 7,000 different federal installations worldwide. At the Department of Homeland Security, Trump and Pence's photos would soon hang next to that of General John Kelly, the new Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, confirmed by a vote of 88-11 on the first day of the Trump administration. 20 days earlier, the officials in the room had been tasked with a massive overhaul of the nation's immigration system in the form of an executive order issued by the president. The directive, titled Border Security and Immigration Enforcement Improvements, was President Trump's way of signaling he was getting right to work on his signature campaign issue, ending undocumented migration to the United States. In the order, he specifically tasked the government with ending catch and release. Section 6, Detention for Illegal Entry. The Secretary shall immediately take all appropriate actions to ensure the detention of aliens apprehended for violations of immigration law pending the outcome of their removal proceedings or their removal from the country to the extent permitted by law. The Secretary shall issue new policy guidance to all Department of Homeland Security personnel regarding the appropriate and consistent use of lawful detention authority under the INA, including the termination of the practice commonly known as catch and release, whereby aliens are routinely released into the United States shortly after their apprehension for violations of immigration law. One policy option for implementation of ending catch and release that was discussed was a referral of minors as part of family units as unaccompanied alien children to ORR, Commander White recalled later in congressional testimony about the Valentine's Day meeting. Translation from government speak. In order to end the catch and release of undocumented adults who arrived with minor children, their kids would be separated, classified as unaccompanied, even though they arrived with their family, and transferred to ORR, where they would be sheltered as refugees while their parents went through the United States criminal justice system. The thought was that word of the separations happening would deter other migrants from coming at all. If we go this route, we need to be ready, is how one former DHS official in the room later described the discussion of family separation to me. Several attendees characterized the mood as celebratory among law enforcement officials advocating for harsher immigration policies. You should buy rubber stamps for your immigration judges that say denied, because that is what they're going to be doing from here on out, an ICE official joked. The display shook some of those at the table who were used to these gatherings being productive interagency conversations during the Obama administration. For those of us who were looking how to institute good governance around immigration, it was a turning point for all of us. Like, this is a new day, a former government official who was present told me. Our voice is not what's going to be echoed in this chamber. Half of us left very shell-shocked. Commander White kept stoic through the meeting despite mounting concern as the idea of systematically separating parents and children to deter others from coming to the United States was raised. This was the same proposal that career ORR employees had opposed when it was considered during the Obama administration. We need a white paper for our secretary, another ORR official present said, attempting to stall, referring to Tom Price, the secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, a physician and former congressman from Georgia, who she believed would ultimately have to sign off on what could potentially be thousands of children taken from their parents. Not long after the meeting concluded, and what was proposed inside the Reagan building was shared amongst ORR staff, the whispers began. They are going to The Hague and I am not going to testify for them, the same ORR employee repeated regularly of Trump administration political appointees pushing the policy. The consequences would be disastrous and obvious. Human rights abuses, running out of beds, violations of international laws and treaties, problems with communication between parents and children, and prohibitive expenses. To stop potential family separations, those in ORR would have to rely on, quote, tricks and mind games to stop those who would try to execute separations. Commander White was more diplomatic about it, at least publicly in the aftermath of the policy, when he confirmed the Valentine's Day meeting took place. On a number of occasions, I and my colleagues made recommendations raising concerns not only about what that would mean for children, but also what it would mean for the capacity of the program, he said. A former DHS official in the room that day remembered any potential pushback differently. Quote, nobody warned of the impact on children. February 16, 2017. One of President Trump's stated goals of his immigration agenda and part of the underlying rationale for a deterrence-based family separation policy was stopping what he said was the single biggest problem along the southwest border, drugs coming in and killing Americans. Trump was right about one thing. It didn't take long to see multiple kilos of hard narcotics after I showed up in a wool jacket at the southern border one frigid morning less than 3 weeks after the inauguration. The packages of the deadly drug were wrapped in plastic, about the size of a mini football that would still be too big for my then one-year-old son to wrap his hands around and throw. When sliced open with a knife, the white powdery substance was instantly visible. I took a step back to avoid inhaling any residue of what could be the drug fentanyl, fueling the most deadly drug overdose crisis in American history. This is the part of the story I knew the president and his advisors wanted people to understand. What was coming across the border? But based on the way he talked about it, I assumed he'd rather not know where I was. The San Ysidro Port of Entry is the largest land border crossing in the world. Tens of thousands of cars and hundreds of thousands of human beings make their way between Tijuana and San Diego on a daily basis. So do an untold volume of narcotics, more than anywhere else along the entire southern border. As President Trump continued to make the case for his big, beautiful border wall, I was curious if it would do what he said. Stop drugs from pouring across the southwest border. At least here, the answer was no way. Most hard narcotics come through legal ports of entry, like this one, and today was no exception. Given candidate and now President Trump's rhetoric, I asked Sidney Aki, the Customs and Border Protection official who oversees San Ysidro, what the biggest threat coming across at San Ysidro was. Standing in between hundreds of cars streaming into the United States, many daily commuters heading to work or school, he explained where the real challenge along the border was. It's everything. We're looking at everyone. We're looking at illegal narcotics, heroin, methamphetamine, cocaine, fentanyl, all entering the borders. That's one of your agents that stands out here, specialized to look for suspicious activity? Correct. But the primary screening lanes, where we were standing, isn't where most of the hard narcotics are found, he explained. Aki took me into what is known as secondary screening, a place where motorists suspected of wrongdoing are moved for a closer look by CBP agents. The same men and women in the blue uniforms who might stamp your passport after you returned from an international trip. Within minutes, that's where we saw the giant load. An excited dog that looked like a German Shepherd was alerting its handler that the gray Chevy sedan with California plates might have drugs inside. It was right. The vehicle was pulled into yet a third location where I watched multiple CBP agents tear apart the car. I'm probably the last person you want to change your tire or oil or even your windshield fluid, but that day I learned what a cowl is. The agents tore open the upper part of the engine below the windshield, and inside they found what the man driving the car, now in handcuffs in a separate room, was smuggling. One after another, they pulled out nearly 30 of those football-sized packages of what, after being sliced open and field-tested, turned out to be methamphetamine. "Is that a normal load?" I asked Pete Flores, the director of all field operations for CBP in the San Diego sector, who had joined us as we filmed. "For us, hard narcotics are trending, particularly heroin and methamphetamine. Packages are getting a little bit smaller for us. The number of them have increased, obviously, because the packaging is smaller in order to put them into deeper concealment into the vehicles." "Is this all you're going to get today?" I would say, if I were a betting person, no. This wouldn't be all that we get today. I would say we could get up to another 5-6 loads today, and that wouldn't be abnormal for us. "Why, if you're a cartel, do you want to send drugs like this through a legal port of entry where you could cross with your passport?" "On a yearly basis, we're going to deal with 75 million travelers coming across the border. Drug smugglers feel there are opportunities to mix in with the general population, who are generally compliant with what the laws are." "So translation," I interpreted. "They think they can sneak it by you." "Right," Flores admitted. Evidence directly contradicting what President Trump had been saying was right in front of my eyes. Most hard narcotics were not coming through unwalled areas. They were entering through legal ports of entry just like this one. None more so than right here between San Diego and Tijuana. That begged a question. If Mexican cartels were smuggling drugs mostly in places you had to show your passport, who was crossing in between the ports, where there were no walls, or trying to get around the ones that did exist? Mostly, it was Central American family members looking to seek asylum. It was a group, now in the crosshairs, of the Trump administration. March 6th, 2017. Roll out. It was 5 in the evening on the dot. Wolf Blitzer's familiar voice punched through a car speaker over CNN's satellite radio network. "President Trump quietly takes another try at a travel ban, this time leaving Iraq off the list of targeted countries and exempting U.S. green card and visa holders. Will the White House face a new legal battle and more protests? I'll speak live to the Secretary of Homeland Security, John Kelly." At least one official driving home from the Office of Refugee Resettlement was listening live. This should be interesting. 3 days earlier, a Reuters reporter named Julia Edwards Ainsley broke publicly what staffers at ORR had been hearing since the Valentine's Day meeting at CBP. The Trump administration was revisiting the rejected Obama-era family separation proposal and was now considering systematically separating migrant kids from their parents. In a major scoop, Ainsley, citing 3 government officials, wrote that wide-scale separations, quote, "to deter mothers from migrating to the United States with their children," had been in the works even before the still unreported Valentine's Day meeting. 2 of the officials were briefed on the proposal at a February 2nd town hall for asylum officers by U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services Asylum Chief John Lafferty. A 3rd DHS official said the department is actively considering separating women from their children, but has not made a decision. Now, Kelly, the man who would ultimately be responsible for operationally putting any separation policy in place, was about to be on national television. What is he going to say? At 10 after the hour, Blitzer addressed Kelly. "General, Mr. Secretary, thanks for joining us, and thank you for your military service as well." They spent 7 minutes talking about the justification, or lack thereof, as Blitzer made clear as he pressed Kelly, for banning travelers from mostly Muslim-majority nations from the United States, until at 17 minutes into the show, they addressed family separations. "Let me get to some other sensitive homeland security issues while I have you," Blitzer began. "Are you, the Department of Homeland Security, considering a new initiative that would separate children from their parents if they tried to enter the United States illegally?" Here we go. Let me start by saying I would do almost anything to deter, Kelly said, admitting right off the bat his goal was frightening people away from the United States. The people from Central America to getting on this very, very dangerous network that brings them up through Mexico and into the United States. And I would underline that the Mexicans are after this network in the same way we are. It's extremely dangerous. I wouldn't say 100%, but certainly in the high 90%, and this is by the social service organizations that inform me from Central America, that the vast majority of the young women, all women, are sexually abused along this. Let me, Blitzer cut him off, sensing Kelly was evading the question. My point is, let me just be precise. Right, Kelly replied. If you get some young kids who manage to sneak into the United States with their parents, are the Department of Homeland Security personnel going to separate the children from their moms and dads? We have tremendous experience in dealing with unaccompanied minors, Kelly said. We turn them over to HHS, and they do a very, very good job of either putting them in kind of foster care or linking them up with parents or family members in the United States. And then, finally, Kelly admitted it. Yes, I am considering, in order to deter more movement along this terribly dangerous network, I am considering exactly that. They will be well cared for as we deal with their parents. Wow. What was until this point a publicly unconfirmed secret was now confirmed by the top government official responsible for carrying it out. He blew the whistle on himself. Blitzer kept pressing Kelly. You understand how that looks to the average person who is, you know, it's more important to me, Wolf, to try to keep people off this awful network. The ORR official, one of many who would ultimately bear the burden of caring for separated children, kept driving home, uncertain of what might happen next. March 10th, 2017. Days later, in Los Angeles, I was on my way to learn more about how immigration enforcement was already tearing families apart. But not because I caught Secretary Kelly's interview. If I did, and I don't remember, it was only a passing glance. I was headed to South El Monte, where on this night, the Catholic Church was training undocumented immigrants already in the United States how to avoid deportation. Producer Mitch Koss had worked out our access. They're training people how not to get deported. It'll be very vivid, he pitched to me in a way that would sound terrifying to many reporters. I trusted him. Mitch had pioneered a free-flowing style of reporting with two young reporters in the 90s, CNN's Anderson Cooper and Lisa Ling, that valued real-time and on-camera explorations of situations. Basically, he taught them, and now me, how to unlearn what most TV reporters are schooled to do. Go to places and actually look around instead of just showing up to use a location as a backdrop for an interview. He taught me how to be a reporter. By the time I got to Epiphany Catholic Church, Iglesia Católica de Epifania, Mitch and our team were there waiting in the dark parking lot outside the church, illuminated by a large neon white cross atop the facade, and under it, blue and yellow light emanating from six panels of stained glass. We were filming a story for the Today Show. Hey, fellas, I said out of the window as I rolled up. Having been bar mitzvahed exactly 30 miles from here, I'm not exactly an expert in who shows up for Friday night mass, but it didn't seem like the normal crowd to me milling about in front. Young kids, what looked like middle and high schoolers, were hanging around outside as parents went in. An 8.5 by 11 inch sheet of paper with a printed message in Spanish with the seal of the Los Angeles Archdiocese up top greeted those entering. Preparing your family for an encounter with immigration. Inside, I met the representative the Archbishop had sent that night, Lucy Boutet. Petite and gray-haired, the outreach coordinator would be giving the presentation, as she had at other churches throughout Los Angeles, based on an official 50-plus page document. Before she went in, I had a question for her. How many people are at risk of an encounter with ICE? She looked down, then up at me through her thin, rectangle-shaped glasses. She lifted up her arm, squeezing her fist into a ball and pulling it back towards her face, purposely drawing my attention to the brown skin on her wrist. Anybody that looks like this is at risk, because they're stopping everybody. That's a lot of people in Los Angeles, I said to her, immediately realizing I had asked a stupid question with an obvious answer. Tell me about it, she replied. We walked inside the sanctuary, and not long after the 7 o'clock service began, Boutte and other representatives from the Archdiocese, the largest in the nation and home to 1 million undocumented people, many of whom were raising American children, made their way to the front of the room, acting out a raid by Immigration and Customs Enforcement as if it were a school play. Open the door! This is ICE! Shouted a man into a microphone as a group stood behind an invisible door. Boutte jumped up, waving her arms in the air in between the man and the family to stop the scene and explain they did not have to open the door, because under the U.S. Constitution, ICE does not have the right to enter without a judicial warrant. Dozens of parishioners watched from the pews, following along with Know Your Rights paperwork handed out to them in Spanish and English. As the training continued, I walked back out front and met Anna Cordova, a 13-year-old wearing her hair in a ponytail, who came to the church with her family to know what to do if the moment they all feared happened. Anna is a U.S. citizen. Her parents are not. You're 13. Why'd you show up here? It's difficult to picture a life without... She trailed off, collecting her thoughts, her braces shining in the neon and stained glass light. Your life, she continued. You know, my mom and dad have always been here for me, and they're literally the world to me, and I wouldn't like to imagine the world without them. You came here tonight to learn what? To learn what happens when someone gets deported, and how to hide or talk your way out of it. 3 days after meeting Anna at her church's training session, she invited me back to South El Monte to meet her undocumented mom and siblings. We piled in their white minivan, me in the way back, in between her little brother and sister, behind two others in the middle row, to get a tour of her neighborhood. She explained that rumors of roadside checkpoints were driving fear. From the shotgun seat acting as a tour guide, Anna explained the checkpoints like two streetlights from here, and she and her mom both pointed to the right. Up that way, I asked? Yeah, they said in unison. And so what does that do? How do people feel? What are people saying? We don't come out. That's why we're kind of, you know, in our shells, Anna said while pushing her fists together, mimicking a shell closing. You stay home? Yes, they again said together. We stay home, Anna said with a sigh. The following morning, March 14th, I met with the Archbishop of Los Angeles, Jose H. Gomez, in the courtyard of the massive Cathedral of Our Lady of the Angels in downtown Los Angeles. He had just taken off his choir cassock, what I thought was called a robe, and his mitre, the bishop hat, after finishing a service inside. Under it, he was wearing a black suit with his clerical collar and a cross the size of a piece of toast. It's a beautiful church, he mused, as we walked outside under the modern structure, completed in 2002 to replace the Cathedral of St. Viviana, which was badly damaged in the 1994 Northridge earthquake. I brought with me the 50-page document that informed Lucy Boutte's presentation and asked him why they were going from church to church preparing families for immigration enforcement. I have been talking about stopping the deportation for a long time because it's breaking families and it's destroying the lives of people. Do you see what you're doing here in Los Angeles as a conflict with the Trump administration? We've been doing this for a long time, as I said. Before with the Obama administration and now with the Trump administration, because we want the undocumented people to really be a part of our society. You think the Pope would like this plan? I wondered aloud, waving the anti-deportation document. Gomez laughed. I'm sure that he does. I've talked to him several times. He's always encouraging me to help people, whatever they need. Candidate Trump had promised a deportation force to my colleagues on Morning Joe, and the specter of wide-scale ICE raids now had to be a top concern to the 1 million undocumented people in Los Angeles. breaking families apart, as the Archbishop pointed out, was not new in a city with more Mexicans and Central Americans than anywhere else in the country. But now they were the stated target of the man in the Oval Office. With so much concern over interior removals, as ICE refers to them, neither the Archbishop, nor the Pope, nor myself understood that another way of breaking families apart, at the border itself, was in the works. April 11th, 2017. The stage had been set for family separation. After President Trump issued the executive order calling for the end of catch and release on the fifth day of his presidency, then Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly revealed on CNN that he was considering the policy, the legal framework needed to be put into place. In a three-page memo, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, the former boss of Stephen Miller, now a senior advisor to President Trump, laid out his case for criminalizing immigration violations, historically treated as a civil offense. It is a high priority of the Department of Justice to establish lawfulness in our immigration system. While dramatic progress has been made at the border in recent months, much remains to be done. It is critical that our work focus on criminal cases that will further reduce illegality. Consistent and vigorous enforcement of key laws will disrupt organizations and deter unlawful conduct. I ask that you increase your efforts in this area, making the following immigration offenses higher priorities. Further guidance and support of executing this priority, including an updated memorandum on charging for all criminal cases, will be forthcoming. In the memo, Sessions cited statute after statute for which migrants could be charged for crossing the border illegally. Entering for the first time, entering after previously being deported, identity theft, assaulting a law enforcement officer. He directed prosecutors at sentencing to seek, quote, judicial orders of removal or deportation, and each federal district to set up a border security coordinator to oversee investigations and prosecutions and report back to Washington. This was the same Jeff Sessions who, in a publicly broadcast conversation with Steve Bannon in 2015, before both were members of the Trump administration, praised a racist 1924 law intended by its author's own admission to end, quote, indiscriminate acceptance of all races as, quote, good for America. Now he had the power of the U.S. Department of Justice to fix what he saw as, quote, a big problem. What Bannon called a, quote, war, to preserve what Sessions believed was about, quote, classical American values. July 4th, 2017. As two fighter jets screamed across the Los Angeles skyline in celebration of Independence Day, my one-year-old son blurted something that sounded like airplane if you said it with a mouthful of marshmallows. That same day, back in Washington, D.C., Commander Jonathan White, known to dress in his perfectly pressed and decorated officer's uniform, was planning ahead. In a memo to his colleagues at the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which I'm sure they appreciated receiving on a federal holiday, White delivered a regularly scheduled update on the status of unaccompanied migrant children in the custody of the United States of America. These types of updates were necessary, as he and the small team he worked with within the Administration for Children and Families, within the Department of Health and Human Services, had learned the hard way during the Obama administration. The surges of unaccompanied children in 2011, 2014, and 2016 caught ORR flat-footed, and when there was not enough shelter space available, thousands of children piled up in Border Patrol stations until the government could find a place for them to be cared for while they waited for what was usually a family member already living in the United States to be vetted and pick them up. Under a new presidential administration with a new set of potential immigration enforcement priorities, White worried available bed space could quickly evaporate. He outlined six factors that could contribute to a sudden surge, but there was one that would send numbers skyrocketing and shelters overflowing, with nearly 10,000 more children sent into his care than projections for current levels. What he called the DHS deterrence model, which had two parts. The first was already operational, and it was designed to stop children from coming to the United States because their undocumented relatives would be scared away from picking them up once they made it to safety. DHS immigration enforcement actions may adversely affect discharge rate. DHS has launched a National Unaccompanied Alien Children Sponsor Initiative, which involves contacting sponsors of UAC who are without legal status, interviewing them, and in some cases taking them into custody, issuing criminal charges against them, or issuing notices to appear. Effects of this initiative upon readiness of individuals to step forward as sponsors are expected to result in significant increases in length of stay and decline in discharge rate. The other part of the deterrence model, White noted, would have similar effects, but wasn't yet launched: family separations. This UAC sponsor initiative step would represent one half of the DHS policy changes necessary to fulfill the DHS deterrence scenario model, since family unit separations are not yet being implemented. ORR is currently reviewing that model to determine if it should be refined to current policy realities. Commander White's insistence that family unit separations are not yet being implemented turned out to be wishful thinking. August 15, 2017. As most career employees walked out of the Department of Health and Human Services for the day and into 80-degree heat and humidity, one stayed behind, dropping a massive clue about the fate of thousands of migrant children in Commander Jonathan White's email inbox. "We have received 27 separations over the last 7 days. The majority of these referrals seem to be coming from El Paso and Phoenix," a staffer at the Office of Refugee Resettlement's Division of Unaccompanied Children Operations explained. White had requested the information about what his briefer called a breakdown of the trends seen in child separations from parents as identified by DHS at the time of referral, both this week and across the last few months. If White and like-minded colleagues were going to prove and somehow stop the Trump administration's practice of what he had heard they might do as early as Valentine's Day, separating families and children for no other reason than to deter others from coming to the United States, he would need the evidence. Separations had always happened, but historically, separations from parents only occurred when the safety and security of children were at risk. If there was a case to be made, it would be in the data White was now looking at. The numbers said that in April, May, June, and July, between 10 and 44 children were taken from their parents at the border each month, between 1 and 2% of overall referrals from the Department of Homeland Security, which was detaining the families. The children were sent to White's colleagues at ORR, who would ultimately care for the children once they were taken from their parents. The percentage of those separations that were due to the civil infraction of entering the United States illegally, not safety concerns for the children or a criminal offense, was only between 13 and 30% during those months. August was only half over, but the data for the month told another story. In only half as many days, between the first of the month and the day before Commander White received this email, 37 children had been separated, and a whopping 54% of them were separated only because of the way they crossed the border. No danger. No illness. No threat. Two separate times in the last week alone, 8 kids were taken from their parents in one day. A separation surge was happening. But there was an even more damning bit of information in the email. In order to prove separations were happening for no other reason than crossing the border illegally, the government would need to keep track of all separations. On that front, White's briefer did not have good news. The government was separating children and parents and losing track of who they were and where they went. "I understand from the field that they are discovering more separations that were not reported in the initial referral. I don't have those numbers." Almost 5 hours after the email was sent, White acknowledged receipt of the shocking information with a simple reply: "Thank you." I am a citizen of Kyrgyzstan and am seeking asylum in the United States. When I came to the United States, I passed my initial asylum interview, credible fear interview, and am now in immigration proceedings before an immigration judge to seek asylum. I'm currently detained in the Otay Mesa Detention Facility. I came to the United States on or around October 18, 2017, with my biological son, T.U., who is 13 years old. He's also from Kyrgyzstan and seeking asylum. When we came to the United States, we sought admission at the San Ysidro Port of Entry, and we said that we wanted to seek asylum. A few days later, I was told that I was going to be separated from my son. I suffer from high blood pressure and felt as though I was having a heart attack. I was not able to ask why they were separating my son from me and did not know what to do. I feel like I was in shock and do not remember what happened next or even how I got to the detention center after that. All I can remember is how much my son and I were both crying as they took him away. I do not recall anyone questioning whether I am really his biological father or whether I was a danger to him or abusive in any way. I even had my son's birth certificate proving I am his father. I was sent to the Otay Mesa Detention Center on or around October 23, 2017. I learned that my son was sent to a facility in Chicago. It has been about 6 months since I last saw my son. We speak over the phone once a week for about 10 minutes. It is not enough. The last time we spoke, it sounded like he had been crying. I worry about him constantly. He is just a boy in a strange land with no parents or relatives with him. He needs me. I feel like this separation is causing TU great harm. He sounds depressed, and each time I speak with him over the phone, he talks less and less. This separation is tearing me apart inside. TU is only 13 years old, and I should be with him to comfort and protect him. I hope I can be reunited with my son very soon. I miss him, and I want to be with him to tell him everything will be all right. I am so scared about how this separation is affecting him. I declare under the penalty of perjury under the laws of the United States of America that the foregoing is true and correct, based on my personal knowledge. Executed in San Diego, California, on April 18, 2018. Declaration of Mr. U. Miss L versus ICE.